Good morning.
Good morning, Sensei. Good morning.
It is my pleasure, as they say, to introduce Mark Echo, E-K-O, Morris, who's from the Heart Circle Sangha in Ridgewood, and his teacher is Roshi Joan Hobricks, and Echo is a Dharma holder, which is the last stop before the train gets to the final stage. I'm going to read a little bit of an introduction to Echo. Unfortunately, my printer would only print this one, so I'll do the best that I can. So Echo is a novice priest and a Dharma holder in the Soto tradition at the Heart Circle Sangha, the Zen meditation community of Ridgewood, New Jersey, where he has been practicing for about 15 years. His duties there include teaching mindfulness classes, introduction to classes, dream workshops, and koans. He also organizes the semi-annual residential retreats and serves on the board of directors. Echo also teaches mindfulness, meditation, and Buddhist thought to inmates at the Adult Diagnostic and Treatment Center in New Jersey. DOC's facility for violent recidivist sex offenders, and coordinates the Buddhist volunteer program there. Echo also served part-time for 2 years as a volunteer Buddhist chaplain at Beth Israel Medical Center in New York City, and for 1 year as a doula for the dying with Valley Hospital home care patients in Bergen County, New Jersey. And he's also an EMT. So I really appreciate him for coming here today.
So good morning.
Good morning.
It's such an honor to be asked by Genjo Sensei to come and speak to you today. Really, it's a special pleasure to be here today because, as Genjo mentioned, I served for a couple of years part-time as a chaplain with the New York Zen Center of Contemplative Care. And Mary Remington was really the driving organizational force behind that group, and I think had an awful lot to do with how successful it's become. It's huge and thriving these days. But I think Mary was really the glue that held that place together in the first 10 years or so. So thank you, Mary, for enabling that excellent training there. That was quite an experience. That experience changed my life. It changed, it was responsible for me changing my career, really. So, anyway. So, as Genjo mentioned, I sit with the Heart Circle Sangha, and twice a year, Heart Circle goes on a weekly residential retreat, once in the spring and once in the fall. And at any given time, we have 4 or 5 people who are eligible to give Dharma talks. So what we've been doing the last few years is selecting a foundational text, and each of the teachers gives a Dharma talk related to that text. So in past years, we've worked with the Diamond Sutra, the Lotus Sutra, the 6 Chinese Patriarchs Platform Sutra. So, and it's worked out really, really well. We have a lot of fun doing it. So this past retreat, we selected this book, Cultivating the Empty Field by Hong Zhi. Hong Zhi is famous for teaching the method called silent illumination. And he's famous for his writings on that topic. And Cultivating the Empty Field is really really his sort of classic on silent illumination. So his work is really broken up into 2 parts. There's a section called Practice Instructions and the second section called Religious Verses. And practice instructions might be a little bit misleading because they're really sort of almost poetical verses. not terribly practical as practice instructions. Really what he does is describe in highly evocative images what silent illumination is all about, and then sort of leaves it to the student to figure out how to actually implement that. So let's see. So the practice instructions section is this much of the book. So it's about, I don't know, maybe 20 pages. And then the religious verses section of the book is that much. So there's not a lot to it, not a lot of pages to it, but there's a lot to it. You know what I mean? The rest of the book is Dan Tygan-Layton's excellent introduction. It's really a wonderful introduction. And then the back is notes. So when I ordered this, I ordered this online. It showed up in the mail, and I saw this slender little volume, and I thought, oh, this is, you know, this won't be a problem to read. So I kept putting it off, and putting it off, and the retreat date kept getting closer and closer, so finally I decided I better get serious about it, and I started reading it, and I started reading Tygan's introduction to it, which I thought, you know, I would just kind of blow through, and I couldn't do it. It's just, it's really a wonderful, you know, Cultivating the Empty Field is considered an ancient Zen classic, but I think Tygan's introduction to it could be considered a modern Zen classic. I really think that if you were on a desert island and the 27 pages of his introduction washed up in a plastic bag and were readable, that you could practice Soto Zen pretty effectively just with that. That's how compelling his intro is. So I was trying to give it short shrift, you know, blow through it to get to the meat of this book, and I just couldn't do it. And the clock was ticking down, the days were flying by, and so it turns out just before retreat, I had some late nights sitting up with the actual text. So anyway, Tygan has a really wonderful way of putting Hongzhi's teachings in several contexts. First, this historical context. He gives a really good biography of Hongzhi, and then also placing him in practice or lineage context. So I'll just recap his intro of Hongzhi a little bit. So Hongzhi, that name means a true awakening, Hongzhi. So it was the first of his Dharma names. His second Dharma name was Jingjue, which means true awakening. So, I'm sorry, his first name was Vast Wisdom. So his names are Vast Wisdom and True Awakening. Some pretty powerful names. He was born in 1091 and was recognized as a prodigy very early in life. By age 7, he is said to have mastered 3,000 Chinese characters, which was probably still is a lot for that age. At age 11, he left home to become a monk, and he went to study with Master Kumu Facheng. And Kumu's style of practice was to sit so still, so immobile, that his body was said to resemble a block of wood. So he became he was nicknamed Dry Wood Complete Dharma. So after a few years with Kumu, he traveled around to other monasteries, as was the practice of the time. And at Incense Mountain, he overheard a monk reciting a line from the Flower Ornament Sutra. He heard, "The eyes which our parents give us can behold 3,000 worlds. And upon hearing this, he experienced awakening. So, Hongzhi had experience with several other teachers, but after spending a few years with Dan Xia, he received transmission. And then continued his wandering around to other temples, and he spent a few years with Yuan Yu Juyuan, who was the collator of the Blue Cliff Record. And the Blue Cliff Record is the usually the second book of koans that we work with in our tradition. So that gave him, spending those years with Yuan Wu gave him an introduction to formal koan practice. And he later went on to create his own collection of koans, which became known as the Book of Serenity, or the Book of Equanimity, which is typically the third book of koans that we work with in our tradition. So although he's known primarily for the technique of silent illumination, he did practice and teach koans as well. Excuse me. In 1129, he accepted an invitation to teach at Jingde Monastery, which is kind of an interesting invitation because at the time the monastery was really dilapidated and broken down, so it's kind of a double-edged invitation. But he accepted it, and under his guidance, the temple was rebuilt and housed up to 1,200 monks, and was usually full. He had quite a following in his day. Excuse me. So Dogen tells a story about Hongzhi's, the generosity of Hongzhi's nature, in that once when Hongzhi's temple had provisions for 1,000 monks, for some reason, he must have been giving a special series of talks or something, but for some reason 1,600 showed up. And the temple manager wanted to turn away the extra monks that they didn't have food or bedding for, and Hongzhi wouldn't hear of it. He insisted that they stay and be accommodated. And on at least one other occasion, a nearby temple of a contemporary of his, a man named De Hay, who was often a frequent critic of Hongzhi's, their temple experienced food shortages. And Hongzhi's temple sent them food to get them through the famine. This was a time, Hongzhi lived in a time of political and military upheaval in China. And this resulted in disruptions to agriculture and other activities. So famine was fairly common. So Hongzhi is known to have donated food to the local villages and to the other temples nearby. So he's very generous in that regard. So in the autumn of 1157, Hongzhi journeyed down the mountain that he hadn't been down Jingde Mountain in 30 years. But he went down in the fall of 1157 to thank and say goodbye to the local military and government officials and to the lay people who had supported the temple. And so he knew he was dying. Then went back up the mountain, and on November 10th, he arose and bathed and put on fresh robes. Then he went to the Dharma Hall and gave the monks a farewell talk. Then he wrote a letter to De Hay, his colleague and sometimes critic, and asked him to take over the affairs of the temple. And then he wrote his death poem. So here's Hongzhi's death poem. Illusory dreams, phantom flowers, 67 years. A white bird vanishes in the mist. Autumn waters merge with the sky. And then he passed away in formal meditation posture. That's a brief recap of Hongzhi's life. So, as I said, Hongzhi is known for this teaching of silent illumination. And basically, his most basic writing on that is this. He says, turn the light around and shine within, then return. That's silent illumination. So, and this is really the Soto Zen paradigm. To, right, we sit and hopefully are in one way or another illuminated. And then we return to what another Zen poem calls the noisy marketplace, the everyday life, and we act from that illumination that has occurred to us in contemplation, in meditation. Taigen puts it a little bit more precisely and maybe prosaically. He says, this oscillation between realizing the ultimate, often actualized through meditation and in the monastic impulse, and functioning responsively in the world, often expressed with the bodhisattva model, becomes the paradigm for Soto practice. So that's really what our lineage is about. We are in the, White Plum is technically in the Soto tradition. And that's really what our practice is essentially about. So sitting in meditation and contemplation, and then acting in the world from that illumination. So it doesn't deny the reality of the relative world, but it asks us to be aware of the absolute and to bring that into our lives seamlessly. That's kind of what we do in a nutshell. That's kind of what we're doing here in this practice. So, as I was reading this, actually reading the introduction where Taigen introduces Hongzhi's teachings, the question occurred to me. So, if Hongzhi is correct that our task is to turn our awareness around to the source of awareness, let body and mind and all other dualities drop away, reside in what he calls the circle of light, in illumination, and then return to the everyday world and act from that awareness. If that's what we have to do, to be awakened, why am I spending hundreds, if not thousands, of hours of my life practicing koans? And in most of the teachers in the White Plum tradition teach koans as well as just sitting practice, this silent illumination practice, which became known as shikantaza in Japanese when it came to Japan. So why do we practice koans? Why is that even a practice in Zen? As Hongzhi says, what we have to do is turn the light of awareness around, drop our dualities, let body and mind fall away, and then return. So, It's a good question, I think. And as someone who spent a long, long time doing koan study, which is hard, it's difficult. And it raises a lot of difficult emotions. So why am I putting myself through that? Why is anyone putting themselves through that? And so I became a little bit obsessed with this question. And so I came up with some answers for myself. And I think the first is that turning the light around, turning our awareness around to the source of awareness is one of those is one of those typically Zen type of instructions that whose simplicity is inversely proportional to its difficulty, right? Most things in Zen, the simpler they sound, the harder they are to do, right? And it's true. This turning the awareness around is, it's not clear that every mind is prepared to do that right out of the gate. On retreat a couple of times with Heart Circle, our teachers introduced a practice developed by Dan Siegel. Anybody here know Dan Siegel? He's an important guy in mindfulness research and the neurology thereof. And he has an exercise that he calls the wheel of awareness, where that tries to get people to the point where they can do that, where they can turn their awareness around. And I've done that exercise with Joan and company a couple of times, and I have to say I struggled with it. I've done it two or three, I can't remember what it's two or three times, but it was a struggle each time. That could be a failure of imagination on my part, or it could have been a statement as to where my practice was at the time or whatever. But I really struggled with it. So it's not clear that everybody's mind is just automatically prepared to be able to turn awareness around upon awareness. On the source of awareness. So, and Hongzhi understood that. And he sort of tells us how to do that, how to get our minds there. So in the very first stanza of the practice instructions, the second line, he says, first you must purify, cure, grind down or brush away all tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. Then you can reside in the clear circle of brightness. Right? So we have to purify, cure, grind down, or brush away. We've got to get rid of that dualistic conditioning that we've been carrying around for forever. Here's another version of that. And this also gives you a flavor for his practice instructions. When the stains from old habits are exhausted, the original light appears, blazing through your skull, not admitting any other matters. Beyond direction, magnificently one entity without edge or seam. When you turn within and drop off everything completely, realization occurs. Here's another one that I really like. Facing everything, let go and attain stability. Stay with that just as that. Stay with this just as this. That and this are mixed together with no discrimination as to their places. Right? Just telling us to just be with whatever is manifesting. Genjo Sensei was at Heart Circle on the 4th of this month and gave an excellent talk there on Jizo's not knowing koan. And in the question and answer period, one of the members asked him a question, and actually forget her question, but she has an avocation. The student has an avocation as a weaver, and she's quite an artist at it. And her question was something about trying to get her mind to the place where she could do her art and this static arising in her mind. And I forget what Genjo answered to the question, but I remember what he asked her after he answered it. And he said, what do you do with the static? And which I thought was a really good question. And he gently suggested to her that the static was not something to be despised or gotten rid of that it's just what was manifesting, and maybe she could find a way to just be with static as just as static. Yeah. And I remember another story that Sharon Salzberg tells, the Vipassana teacher, Sharon Salzberg. she and Joseph Goldstein were leading a meditation retreat once, and the teachers were taking a break in the kitchen having tea, and a student came rushing in and said, I was just sitting outside in the hall and I had this terrible pain in my knee, and I realized I'm just such a horrible person. I'm just a failure as a person. I'm so constricted. And Goldstein stopped him and said, you mean you had a pain in your knee? And the guy said, yeah, I had this terrible pain. And I just realized I'm just such a failure. I've never known true love, and I don't think I can love truly. And Goldstein's like, you mean you had a pain in your knee? Yeah, so he's trying to get him to, not that we shouldn't explore our experience, but he's trying to get him in meditation to just be with what is as it is. So that's kind of what Hongzhi is talking about here. So anyway, getting back to the point, it's not clear that every mind is just innately prepared to turn the light of our attention around. You know, we may need some prep work to do that. Well, koan practice is one of the things that can help us with that. And I started exploring with myself how they do that. Right. So the first way that I think koans help us is they serve as a correction or a corrective to our understanding, right? So if you think about Hongzhi's temple with 1,200 monks in it, first thing to note is that although he taught at least 1,200 monks, he did not have 1,200 successors. So it's not clear that this practice is all that easy to necessarily achieve full awakening with, right? And I mentioned that he was in fairly constant communication with another teacher of his day, a man named Dehei. And if you look up Hongzhi, you know, if you Google Hongzhi on the internet, you'll see a lot made about his alleged feud with Dehei. And it would give you the impression that they were bitter enemies. But Taigen's research indicates that's not the case. That actually they collaborated fairly closely. And as I mentioned, at the end of his life, Hongzhi asked Dehei to take over his temple and also sent Dehei's temple food when they needed it. And they referred students to each other. And so they were actually much more colleagues than anything else. Nonetheless, excuse me, Dehei did have criticisms of Hongzhi's focus on silent illumination, and taken out of context, they can sound quite harsh. So one thing he said was that the practice of silent illumination teaches people to stop and rest and play dead. He said they sit wordlessly with eyes shut and do not seek wondrous enlightenment. And he also said that he felt the focus on silent illumination produces an addiction to calmness. So he's pointing out that meditation practice can be misused. It can be misapplied or maybe limited is a better word. We probably all know people or have known people who use their practice basically for self-soothing, who use it to feel better. And so if they're using practice to achieve a particular state, then this is a form of duality, right? We're picking this state over that state, you know. It's not morally wrong or something like that. It's just limiting. It's going to limit their ability to achieve awakening because they're practicing for a particular goal. And that goal is to feel good. So if you think about Hongzhi's monastery with its 1,200 monks, you know, so there's this huge meditation hall full of, you know, these bald heads and closed eyes. You know, how do you know what's going on behind those eyes? You know, you don't. Really. So is it hard to imagine there are some slackers out there? Probably are. You know, or simply people who don't understand the instruction. So in a situation like that, you could go on for years. You could go on practicing for decades like that and not really know any better. But if you were practicing koans and you were reporting to your teacher on a regular basis on your koan, you would know. You'd know for sure. You know? Because your teacher would be able to see where you are in your practice. And you would be able to see where you are in your practice. So first and foremost, I think koan study can serve as a corrective to our understanding. You know? And this applies to us too, right? I'm sure some of the people here, I know I have had the experience where, you know, I have a little epiphany and I think, I got this, you know, I'm done, you know, stick a fork in me, I got this, you know, until life, you know, slaps me upside the head. As a matter of fact, I saw a little poem about this in Genjo's excellent new book. Have you guys seen this? So there's a poem that I found that talks to that experience. This is on page 60. Leaving the Zendo, feeling close to Satori, a car cuts me off. Right. Car cuts me off. All that anger, all that arising. Right? Yeah. So it's easy to go there. And why not? You know, that feeling of a breakthrough feels pretty powerful, you know? And without something to sort of balance our understanding, we could go down that path of thinking, we got this. We're done. Don't need to practice anymore. So I think, koan practice serves as a corrective to our understanding, certainly to mine. So another thing koan study does is it often allows us to see everyday situations in our life in a new way. And often from a more enlightened perspective. Which, if you think about it, is not... I guess I should take a step back. Is there anyone who doesn't know what koan... Maybe I should just level set there. So for anyone who doesn't know, first of all, I apologize for going so far down the road without defining this. But koans are short Zen stories. They are typically... and they're collected in various... collections like this, or like the Blue Cliff Record that I mentioned, or the Book of Serenity. And they're typically stories about encounters between Zen students and their masters. There are some variations on that, and there are a couple of one-offs, but most of them, I would say about 98% of them seem to be, or the ones that I've seen anyway, are about students and teachers. And when you read them, they make no sense. I'll give you the basic one, the first one out of this book, the famous Joshu's dog, also known as Mu. So the koan goes, koan's very simple. It says, a monk asked Joshu in all earnestness, does a dog have Buddha nature? Joshu answered, Mu. That's the whole koan. How long did you say you sat with that, Kendra?
2 years.
2 years. 2 years. So the way we work with koans is the typical student exhausts every possible rational thought about that. We think every possible form of logical, discursive, rational thought about it until we've exhausted every way there is to think about it. And then, if we're lucky, the teacher's true meaning emerges. And then the way they're presented is The first presentation is to embody the koan. They're presented non-verbally at first, just with our bodies. And if the teacher accepts your presentation, then typically you're asked to how you see it, to explain your understanding of it. So that's koan practice. And these stories are designed to disrupt our normal dualistic thinking. And by doing that, we can see our dualistic thinking. So that's why it shouldn't be terribly surprising that koan study helps us see elements of our own life in new ways, because they're constantly disrupting our thinking. And I can give you an example from my own recent experience about this. So last year, at the end of October, as I mentioned earlier, I'm in the process of changing careers, and I thought I had a job in my new career as a psychotherapist here in New Jersey. So I retired took early retirement from my old job, and unfortunately, some issues came up. Anyway, the new job fell through, so I found myself out of work for the last year or so, and I wasn't really aware that I was kind of holding on to that identity as breadwinner. But I was kind of at sixes and sevens about like what to do with myself. And I knew I didn't feel entirely good most of the time. But I was working on a koan a few months ago that was all about letting go. And finally the light dawned on my head that I had been holding on to this role, this identity. And when I saw that, I was able to let go of that and sort of embrace my new role as house husband. And so I've taken over like meal planning and shopping, and now it's like a mission to make sure that my wife has a tasty meal to come home to when she comes home from her role as breadwinner. And it's become important to me to do that. And so I'm happier. I feel more fulfilled. And my wife is thrilled. So we're happier together as a couple. So, but I don't know how long I would have, because I wasn't even aware that I was holding on to that until the koan helped me see it. You know, and I don't know how long I would have held on to that. So koan study can help us see our own lives in the present. In different ways, in more enlightened ways, in ways, useful ways, helpful ways. So that's another reason to engage in it. And sort of allied with that, they can help us see unconscious dualities that we're holding on to. You know, things that we believe, or beliefs that we hold that we're not even aware that we hold. And I use the parallel to psychotherapy. There are lots of modes of psychotherapy, but excluding the behavioral modes, the modes that we call psychodynamic really have as their basic theory that we hold things in our unconscious that drive our thoughts and words and behavior. But because we're not conscious of them, we're unaware that they're driving us. So the therapist's job is to help the client bring those things into consciousness where they can be worked on and hopefully acknowledged and detoxified and eventually let go of. So that's kind of, in broad brushstrokes, that's kind of the model for the psychodynamic therapies. So, but I think something similar or analogous operates in the area of dualities as well. I think there are dualities that we hold that we're not even aware of. And because we're not aware of them, it's hard to let go of them. If we don't let go of them, then we're not going to reach, body and mind are not going to drop away, as Hongzhi tells us. So I think, Yeah, I've been trying to think of an example of this, and I don't really have one, so I can't really substantiate this, but I really do think something parallel operates in us, that we, as very early children, maybe even pre-verbally, we absorb beliefs about the world that are essentially dualistic in nature, and that we're just not aware of them. We can't let go of them unless we can become aware of them. But because koans are constantly disrupting our thought processes, they help that stuff percolate up to the surface. But koans give us the opportunity, and some people who do this practice might quibble with me about that word opportunity, but they give us the opportunity to practice with difficult emotions in a relatively safe environment. By safe, I mean psychologically safe environment. Koans studies bring up lots and lots of negative feelings. They bring up a lot of frustration. They bring up anger. They bring up feelings of inadequacy. It's not unusual to indulge in self-shaming and a lot of negative talk to ourselves. You know, I'm so stupid. How could I, you know, why did I even think about that present? You know, and this is rarely, if ever, the fault of the teacher. This is stuff that we do to ourselves. So it brings up a lot of negative feelings, and these feelings are all about self. They're all about ego self. So we get a chance to work with them in the company of people that we know, some part of us knows really cares for us. That it really is safe to expose ourselves in this way. And if you think about it, often when we experience these emotions out in the wild, so to speak, it's not so safe. It's not always so safe to experience these things. And we get defensive and our walls come up. So Koan study gives us the opportunity to work with those very, very tender feelings in a safe place. And I think that's really important. And the last point is that they give us a language to talk about the absolute. Notice when we start talking about the ultimate or the absolute, we have to use languages developed in the relative world to do that, and it just doesn't work, right? It's like trying to use a flathead screwdriver on a Phillips head screw. It's not, you know, it's not that there's anything wrong with the screwdriver or the screw. They just don't relate to each other. They just don't work well. So Koan studies gives us a way, particularly gives teachers a way, to kind of talk about the absolute, you know, without getting tongue-tied. So I guess I'll wrap this up with the final image from Hongji's lineage. So Dogen tells a story about Yaoshan Weiyan, who was a teacher of Shito, who was one of Hongji's teachers. All right, so we have many, many years of Zen teachers involved in the story. So the story Dogen tells is a monk asked Yaoshan what he thought about when he meditated. And Yaoshan said, he thought about that doesn't think. And the monk asked, how do you do that? And Yaoshan replied, beyond thinking. I'll leave it at that. Thank you so much for your attention. It's been wonderful to be here today and speak to you. I hope this was useful.